Chapter 2. The Dark One's Touch. Bayonin woke at first light, as was her habit, though little of the dawn trickled into her tent past the closed door flap. Habits were good when they were the right habits. She had taught herself a number over the years. The air inside the tent held a touch of the night's chill, but she left the brazier unlit. She did not intend to remain long. Channeling briefly, she lit a brass lamp, then heated the water in the white glazed pitcher and washed her face at the rickety washstand with its bubbled mirror. Nearly everything in the small round tent was unsteady, from the tiny table to her narrow camp cot, and the only sturdy piece, a low-backed chair, was rude enough to have come from the poorest farm kitchen. She was accustomed to making do, though. Not all of the judgments she had been called on to make had been given in palaces. The meanest hamlet also deserved justice. She had slept in barns and even hovels to make it so. Moving deliberately, she put on the best riding dress she had with her, a plain gray silk that was very well cut, and snug boots that came to her knees, then began brushing her dark golden hair with an ivory-backed hairbrush that had belonged to her mother. Her reflection in the mirror was slightly distorted. For some reason, that irritated her this morning. Someone scratched at the tent flap, and a man called cheerily in a Mirandian accent, "Breakfast, Aes Sedai, if it pleases you." She lowered the brush and opened herself to the source. She had not acquired a personal serving woman, and it often seemed a new face brought every meal, yet she remembered the stout, graying man with the permanent smile who entered at her command, carrying a tray covered with a white cloth. "Leave it on the table, please, Evan," she said, releasing Sidar, and was rewarded with a widening of his smile, a deep bow over the tray, and another before he left. Too many sisters forgot the small courtesies to those beneath them. Small courtesies were the lubricant of daily life. Eyeing the tray without enthusiasm, she resumed her brushing, a twice-a-day ritual that she always found soothing. Rather than finding comfort in the brush sliding through her hair this morning, however, she had to make herself complete the full 100 strokes before laying the brush on the washstand beside the matching comb and hand mirror. Once she could have taught the hills patience, yet that had become harder and harder since Saladar, and nearly impossible since Murundi. So she schooled herself to it, as she had schooled herself to go to the White Tower against her mother's stern wishes, schooled herself to accept the tower's discipline along with its teaching. As a girl, she had been headstrong, always aspiring to more. The tower had taught her that you could achieve much if you could control yourself. She prided herself on that ability. Self-control or no self-control, lingering over her breakfast of stewed prunes and bread proved as difficult as completing her ritual with the hairbrush. The prunes had been dried, and perhaps too old to begin with. They had been stewed to mush, and she was sure she had missed a few of the black flecks that decorated the crusty bread. She tried to convince herself that anything that crunched between her teeth was a barley grain or a rye seed. This was not the first time she'd eaten bread containing weevils, yet it was hardly a thing to enjoy. The tea had a strange aftertaste, too, as though that also was beginning to spoil. When she finally replaced the linen cloth over the carved wooden tray, she very nearly sighed. How long before nothing edible remained in the camp? Was the same happening inside Tar Valon? It must be so. The Dark One was touching the world, a thought as bleak as a field of jagged stones. But victory would come. She refused to entertain any other possibility. Young Althor had a great deal to answer for, a very great deal, yet he must achieve that somehow. Somehow. But the dragon reborn lay beyond her purview. All she could do was watch events unfold from afar. She had never liked sitting to one side and watching. All this bitter musing was useless. It was time to be moving. She stood up so quickly that her chair toppled over backward, but she left it lying there on the canvas ground cloth. Putting her head out at the door flap, she found Tervail on a stool on the walkway, his dark cloak thrown back, leaning on the scabbarded sword propped between his boots. The sun stood on the horizon, 2/3 of a bright golden ball, Yet dark clouds in the other direction, massing around Dragon Mount, suggested more snow before long, or perhaps rain. The sun felt close to warm after the previous night. Either way, with luck, she could be snug indoors soon. Tervail gave a small nod to acknowledge her without stopping what appeared to be an idle study of everyone who moved in his sight. There were none but laborers at the moment, men in rough woolens carrying baskets on their backs, men and women just as roughly clad driving high-wheeled carts laden with bound firewood and sacks of charcoal and water barrels that clattered along the rutted street. At least his scrutiny would have seemed idle to someone lacking the warder bond with him. Her Tervail, he was focused as a drawn arrow. It was only the men he studied, and his gaze lingered on those he did not know personally. With two sisters and a warder dead at the hands of a man who could channel, it seemed beyond possibility there could be two murderers of that sort. Everyone was leery of strange men. Everyone who knew, at least. The news had hardly been shouted abroad. How he thought he might recognize the killer was beyond her unless the man carried a banner, but she would not upbraid or belittle him for trying to perform his duty. Whipcord lean, with a strong nose and a thick scar along his jaw earned in her service, he had been little more than a boy when she found him, cat-quick, and already one of the finest swordsmen in her native Tarabon. And for all the years since, there had never been a moment when he did less. At least 20 times he had saved her life. Quite aside from brigands and footpads too ignorant to recognize an Aes Sedai, the law could be dangerous when one side or the other became desperate not to have the judgment go against them, and often he had spotted the peril before she herself. "Saddle Winterfinch for me and bring your own horse," she told him. "We are going for a little ride." Tervail raised one eyebrow slightly, half glancing in her direction, then attached the scabbard to the right side of his belt and set off down the wooden walkway toward the horse lines, walking very quickly. He never asked unnecessary questions. Perhaps she was more agitated within than she believed. Ducking back inside, she carefully wrapped the hand mirror in a silk scarf woven in a black and white Tyran maze and tucked it into one of the two large pockets sewn inside her good gray cloak, along with the hairbrush and comb. Her neatly folded shawl and a small box of intricately carved blackwood went into the other. The box contained a few pieces of jewelry, some that had come down from her mother and the rest from her maternal grandmother. She herself seldom wore jewelry aside from her great serpent ring, yet she always took the box and the brush, comb, and mirror with her when she journeyed, reminders of the women whose memories she loved and honored, and of what they had taught her. Her grandmother, a noted advocate in Tanchico, had infused her with a love for the intricacies of the law, while her mother had demonstrated that it was always possible to better yourself. Advocates rarely became wealthy, though Kolaris certainly had been more than comfortable. Yet despite her disapproval, her daughter Aeldreen had become a merchant and amassed a tidy fortune buying and selling dyes. Yes, it was always possible to better yourself, if you seized the moment when it appeared, as she had when Elida Arroyhan deposed Swan Sanche. Matters since had not gone anywhere near as she had foreseen, of course. Matters seldom did. That was why a wise woman always planned alternative paths. She considered waiting inside for Tervail to return. He could not fetch 2 horses in mere minutes. But now that the time had actually arrived, her last stores of patience seemed to flee. Settling the cloak around her shoulders, she snuffed the lamp with an air of finality. Outside, however, she forced herself to stand in one place rather than pacing along the walkway's rough planks. Pacing would attract eyes, and perhaps some sister who thought she was fearful of being alone. In all truth, she was afraid, a little. When a man could kill you, unseen, undetected, it was most reasonable to be afraid. She did not want company, though. She pulled up her cowl, signaling a desire for privacy, and drew the cloak around her. A gray cat, notch-eared and lean, began stropping himself against her ankles. There were cats all over the camp. They appeared anywhere that Aes Sedai gathered, tame as house pets, however feral they had been before. After a few moments without having his ears scratched, the cat strolled away, as proud as a king, in search of someone who would see to them. He had plenty of candidates. Just moments earlier, there had been only roughly garbed laborers and cart drivers in view. but now the camp began to bustle. Clusters of white-clad novices, the so-called families, scurried along the walkways to reach their classes, held in any tent large enough to accommodate them, or even in the open. Those who hurried by her ceased their childish prattle to offer perfect curtsies in passing. The sight never ceased to amaze her, or to produce anger. A fair number of those children were well into their middle years or older. No few had at least some gray in their hair, and some were grandmothers. Yet they were bending to the ancient routines as well as any girl she'd ever seen come to the tower. And so many! A seemingly endless flood pouring down the streets. How much had the tower lost through its focus on bringing in girls born with the spark and those already on the brink of channeling through their own fumbling while leaving the rest to find their way to Tarvalin as they would or could? How much lost through insisting no girl above 18 could submit to the discipline? Change was nothing she had ever sought. Law and custom ruled an Aes Sedai's life, a bedrock of stability, and some changes, such as these novice families, seemed too radical to go on. But how much had the tower lost? Sisters glided along the walkways, too, usually in pairs or even threes, usually trailed by their warders. The flow of novices parted around them in ripples of curtsies, ripples made jagged by the stares directed at the sisters who pretended not to notice. Very few of the Aes Sedai lacked the glow of the power around them. Bayanin came close to clicking her tongue in irritation. The novices knew that Anaya and Chiron were dead. There had been no thought of hiding the funeral pyres, but telling them how the two sisters had died would simply have frightened them. The newest, added to the novice book in Murundi, had worn white long enough to be aware that sisters walking about filled with Sayadar was beyond unusual, though. Eventually that alone would frighten them, and to no purpose. The killer seemed unlikely to strike in public, with dozens of sisters about. 5 mounted sisters riding slowly eastward, none carrying the light of Sayadar, caught her eye. Each was followed by a small entourage, generally a secretary, a serving woman, perhaps a serving man as well in case of heavy lifting, and some warders. All rode with their hoods up, but she had no difficulty making out who was who. Varalyn, of her own gray, would have been tall as a man, while Takima the brown was a tiny thing. Soroya's cloak was flamboyant with white embroidery. She must use Sayadar to keep it so sparkling bright. And a pair of warders trailing Faisella marked her as clearly as her brilliant green cloak. Which made the last, wrapped in dark gray, Magla the yellow. What would they find when they reached Darain? Surely not negotiators from the tower, not now. Perhaps they thought they must go through the motions anyway. People frequently continued to go on as they had been after all purpose in it had been lost. That seldom lasted long with Aes Sedai, however.
They hardly seem to be together at all, do they, Bayanin? You might think they just happened to be riding in the same direction.
So much for the cowl providing a modicum of privacy. Luckily, she was practiced at suppressing sighs or anything else that might give away more than she wished. The two sisters who had stopped beside her were much of a height, both small-boned, dark-haired, and brown-eyed, but their resemblance ended. Ashmanila's narrow face with its pointed nose seldom displayed any emotion at all. Her silk dress, slashed with silver, might have come from a tirewoman's hands only moments before, and silver scrollwork decorated the edges of her fur-lined cloak and cowl. Phaedrine's dark wool bore a number of creases, not to mention several stains. Her woolen cloak was unadorned and needed darning, and she frowned much too often as she was doing right then. She might have been pretty without that. An odd pair of friends, the usually unkempt brown, and the gray who paid as much attention to her clothes as to anything else. Bayanin glanced at the departing sitters. They did appear to be riding in the same direction by chance, more than riding together. It was a measure of her upset this morning that she had failed to note that. "Perhaps," she said, turning to face her unwanted visitors, "they are contemplating the consequences of last night. Yes, Ashmanila? Unwelcome or not, courtesy must be observed." "At least the Amarlin is alive," the other gray replied, "and by what I've been told, she will remain alive and healthy. Her and Liana both." Not even Nynaeve's healing of Swan and Lyanna could make anyone speak of stilling with ease. Alive and a captive, it is better than being beheaded, I suppose, but not a great deal better. When Morvryn woke her to tell her the news, it had been hard to share the Brown's excitement. Excitement for Morvryn, at least. The woman had worn a small grin. Baenin had never considered altering her plans, though. Facts, they must be faced. Egwene was a prisoner, and that was that. "Do you not agree, Phaedrine?" "Of course," the Brown replied curtly. "Curtly!" But that was Phaedrine, always so immersed in whatever had caught her attention that she forgot how she should behave, and she was not done. "But that is not why we sought you. Ashmanila says you have considerable acquaintance with murders." A sudden gust of wind snatched at their cloaks, but Baenin and Ashmanila caught theirs smoothly. Phaedrine let hers swirl behind her, eyes intent on Baenin. "Perhaps you have had some thoughts on our murders, Baenin," Ashmanila said smoothly. "Will you share them with us? Phaedrine and I have been putting our heads together, but we are getting nowhere. My own experience is more with civil matters. I know that you have gotten to the bottom of a number of unnatural deaths." Of course she had thought on the murders. Was there a sister in the camp who had not? She herself could not have avoided it had she tried. Finding a murderer was a joy, far more satisfying than settling a boundary dispute. It was the most heinous of crimes, the theft of what could never be recovered, all the years that would never be lived, all that might have been done in them. And these were the deaths of Aes Sedai, which surely made it personal for every sister in the camp. She waited for a last covey of white-clad women, two with grey hair, to make their curtsies and hurry on. The number of novices on the walkways was finally beginning to thin out. The cats seemed to be following them. Novices were more free with petting than most sisters. "The man who stabs from greed," she said once the novices were beyond hearing. "The woman who poisons from jealousy, they are one thing. This is quite another altogether. There are two killings, surely by the same man, but well over a week apart. That implies both the patience and the planning. The motive is unclear, yet it seems very unlikely that he chose his victims by chance. Knowing no more of him than the fact that he can channel, you must begin by looking at what ties the victims together. In this case, Anaya and Chiron, they were both Blue Aja. So I ask myself, what connection has the Blue Aja with a man who can channel? The answer comes back, Moiraine Domodred and Randall Thor. And Chiron, she also had contact with him, yes?" Phaedrine's frown deepened to near a scowl. "You cannot be suggesting he is the killer." Really, she was getting much too far above herself. "No," said Baenin coolly. "I am saying you must follow the connection, which leads to the Ashaman, men who can channel. Men who can channel, who know how to travel. Men who have some reason to fear Aes Sedai, perhaps particular Aes Sedai more than others. A connection is not the proof," she admitted reluctantly, "but it is suggestive, yes?"
"Why would an Ashaman come here twice and each time kill one sister? That sounds as though the killer wanted those two and no others."
Ashmanila shook her head.
"How could he know when Anaya and Chiron would be alone? You cannot think he is lurking about disguised as a workman. From all I hear, these Ashaman are far too arrogant for that. To me, it seems more likely we have an actual workman who can channel and bears a grudge of some sort."
Baenin sniffed dismissively. She could feel Tervale approaching. He must have run to be back so soon.
"And why would he have waited until now? The last workmen they were taken on in Murundi, more than a month ago."
Ashmanila opened her mouth, but Phaedrine darted in, quick as a sparrow snatching a crumb.
"He might have only just learned how. A male wilder, as it were. I've overheard workmen talking. As many admire the Ashaman as fear them. I've even heard some say they wish they had the nerve to go to the Black Tower themselves."
The other Grey's left eyebrow twitched, as much as both shooting to her hairline in another woman. The two were friends, yet she could not be pleased with Phaedrine plucking the words from her mouth in that way. All she said, though, was,
"An Ashaman could find him, I'm sure."
Bannon let herself feel Tervail, waiting only a few paces behind her now. The bond carried a steady flow of unwavering calm and patience as strong as the mountains. How she wished she could draw on that, as she could on his physical strength. "That is most unlikely to happen, I'm sure you will agree," she said thinly. Romanda and the others might have stood in favor of this nonsensical alliance with the Black Tower, but from that moment on they had fought like drunken cart drivers over how to implement it, how to word the agreement, how to present it, every single detail torn apart, put back together, and torn apart again. The thing was doomed, thank the light. "I must go," she told them, and turned to take Winterfinch's reins from Tervail. His tall bay gelding was sleek and powerful and fast, a trained warhorse. Her brown mare was stocky and not fast, yet she had always preferred endurance to speed. Winterfinch could keep going long after taller, supposedly more powerful animals gave up. Putting a foot in the stirrup, she paused with her hands on tall pommel and cantle. "Two sisters dead, Ashmanila, and both blues. Find sisters who knew them and learn what else they had in common. To locate the murderer, you must follow the connections." "I doubt very much they will lead to Ashaman, Bannon." "The important thing is that the killer is found," she replied, pulling herself into the saddle, and turned Winterfinch away before the other woman could go on. An abrupt ending, and discourteous, but she had no more wisdom to offer, and time seemed to press down on her now. The sun was clear of the horizon and climbing. After so long, time pressed very hard indeed. The ride to the traveling ground used for departures was short, but near a dozen Aes Sedai were waiting in a line outside the tall canvas wall, some leading horses, some cloakless as if they expected to be indoors before long, and one or two wearing their shawls for some reason. About half were accompanied by warders, several of whom wore their color-shifting cloaks. The one thing the sisters shared was that each shone with the glow of the power. Tervail expressed no surprise at their destination, of course, but more than that, the warder bond continued to carry steady calm. He trusted her. A silvery flash appeared inside the walls, and after sufficient time to count slowly to 30, a pair of greens, who could not make a gateway alone, entered together with four warders leading horses. The custom of privacy already had attached itself to traveling. Unless someone allowed you to see her weave a gateway, trying to learn where she was going was accounted akin to asking direct questions about her business. Bayonin waited patiently on Winterfinch, with Tervail towering over her on Hammer. At least the sisters here respected her raised cowl, or perhaps they had their own reasons for silence. Either way, she did not have to talk with anyone. At this moment, that would have been insupportable. The line in front of her dwindled quickly, and soon enough she and Tervail were dismounting at the head of a much shorter line, only three sisters. He held aside the heavy canvas flap for her to enter first. Hung between tall poles, the wall enclosed a space of nearly 20 paces by 20 where frozen slush covered the ground, an uneven surface marked by footprints and hoofprints atop one another, and scored in the middle by a razor-straight line. Everyone used the middle. The ground glistened faintly, perhaps the beginning of another thaw that would turn it all to slush that might well freeze again. Spring came later here than in Tarabon, but it was on the brink. As soon as Tervail let the canvas fall, she embraced Sidar and wove spirit almost caressingly. This weave fascinated her. A rediscovery of something thought lost forever, and surely the greatest of Egwene Alvir's discoveries. Every time she wove it, she felt a sense of wonder, so familiar as novice and even accepted, that had not come to her since she attained the shawl. Something new and marvelous. The vertical silvery line appeared in front of her, right atop the scoring on the ground, and suddenly became a gap that widened, the view through appearing to rotate until she was faced by a square hole in the air, more than 2 paces by 2, that showed snow-draped oaks with heavy spreading limbs. A light breeze blew through the gateway, rippling her cloak. She had often enjoyed walking in that grove or sitting on one of the low branches for hours reading, though never in snow. Turveil did not recognize it and darted through, sword in hand, tugging hammer behind him, the warhorse's hooves kicking up puffs of snow on the other side. She followed a little more slowly and let the weave dissipate almost reluctantly. It truly was wondrous. She found Turveil looking at what rose above the treetops in the near distance, a thick, pale shaft rearing against the sky. The White Tower. His face was very still, and the bond seemed filled with stillness, too.
"I think me you are planning something dangerous, Bannon."
He still held his blade bared, though lowered now. She laid a hand on his left arm. That should be enough to reassure him. She would never have impeded his sword arm if there was any real danger.
"No more dangerous than his net."
The words trailed off as she saw a woman some 30 paces away, walking slowly toward her through the grove of massive trees. She must have been behind a tree before. An Aes Sedai in a dress of old-fashioned cut, with straight white hair held back by a pearl-studded cap of silver wire and falling to her waist. It could not be. That strong face with its dark, tilted eyes and hooked nose was unmistakable, though. Unmistakable? But Turanin Murdagon had died when Bayonin was accepted. In mid-step, the woman vanished.
"What is it?"
Turveil spun, his sword coming up, to stare in the direction she had been looking.
"What frightened you?"
"The Dark One. He is touching the world," she said softly.
It was impossible. Impossible, but she was not given to delusions or fancies. She had seen what she had seen. Her shiver had nothing to do with standing ankle-deep in snow. Silently she prayed.
"May the light illumine me all of my days, and may I shelter in the Creator's hand in the sure and certain hope of salvation and rebirth."
When she told him about seeing a sister more than 40 years dead, he did not try to dismiss it as hallucination, merely muttered his own prayer half under his breath. She felt no fear in him, though. Plenty in herself, but none in him. The dead could not frighten a man who took each day as his last. He was not so sanguine when she revealed what she intended. Part of it, anyway. She did so, looking into the hand mirror and weaving very carefully. She was not as adept with illusion as she would have liked. The face in the mirror changed as the weave settled on her. It was not a great change, but the face was no longer an Aes Sedai's face, no longer Bayonin Marinya's face, just that of a woman who looked vaguely like her, though with much paler hair.
"Why do you want to reach Elida?"
he demanded suspiciously. Abruptly the bond carried an edge.
"You mean to get close to her? Then lower the illusion, yes? She will attack you and—" "No, Bayonin. If it must be done, let me go. There are too many warders in the tower for her to know them all, and she will never expect a warder to attack her. I can put a dagger in her heart before she knows what is happening."
He demonstrated, a short blade appearing in his right hand, quick as lightning. "What I do, I must do myself, Turveil." Inverting the illusion and tying it off, she prepared several other weaves, just in case matters went too far awry, inverting them also. Then began another, a very complex weave that she laid on herself. That would hide her ability to channel. She had always wondered why some weaves, such as illusion, could be placed on yourself, while it was impossible to make others, such as healing, touch your own body. When she had asked that question as accepted, Turanin had said in that memorable deep voice,
"As well ask why water is wet and sand dry, child. Put your mind on what is possible rather than why some things are not."
Good advice, yet she never had been able to accept the second part. The dead were walking.
"May the light illumine me all the days of—"
She tied off the last weave and removed her great serpent ring, tucking it into her belt pouch. Now she could stand beside any Aes Sedai, unrecognized for what she was. "You have always trusted me to know what is best," she went on. "Do you still?" His face remained as smooth as a sister's,
yet the bond brought an instant of shock.
But of course, Bayonin.
Then take Winterfinch and go into the city. Hire a room at an inn until I come for you.
He opened his mouth, but she raised an admonitory hand. Go, Tervail.
She watched him disappear through the trees, leading both horses, then turned to face the tower. The dead were walking. But all that mattered was that she reach Elida. Only that. Gusts of wind rattled the casements set in the windows. The fire on the white marble hearth had warmed the air to the point that moisture condensed on the glass panes and trickled down like raindrops. Seated behind her gilded writing table with her hands calmly folded on the tabletop, Elida d'Auvrinia Royhan, the Watcher of the Seals, the Flame of Tarvalin, the Ammerlin's Seat, kept a smooth face while she listened to the man in front of her rant, shoulders hunched and shaking his fist.
"Did be kept bound and gagged for most of the voyage, confined day and night to a cabin better called a cupboard. For that I demand the captain of that vessel be punished, Elida. More, I do demand an apology from you and from the White Tower. Fortune stab me! The Ammerlin's Seat does no have the right to kidnap kings any longer. The White Tower does no have that right. I do demand—"
He was repeating himself again. The man barely paused for breath. It was difficult to keep her attention on him. Her eyes wandered to the bright tapestries on the walls, the neatly arrayed red roses on white plinths in the corners. Tiresome, maintaining outward calm while enduring this tirade. She wanted to stand up and slap him. The audacity of the man, to speak so to the Ammerlin's Seat. But enduring calmly served her purpose better. She would let him exhaust himself. Matin Stepanaeus den Balgar was muscular, and he might have been good-looking when young, but the years had proven unkind. The white beard that left his upper lip bare was neatly trimmed, but the hair had retreated from most of his scalp. His nose had been broken more than once, and his scowl deepened creases on his flushed face that needed no deepening. His green silk coat, embroidered on the sleeves with the golden bees of Ilion, had been brushed and cleaned well, short of a sister channeling to do the work. Yet it had been his only coat for the voyage, and not all the stains had come out. The ship carrying him had been slow, arriving late the day before, but for once she was not displeased with someone else's slowness. The light only knew what a mess Alviarin would have made of matters had he arrived in a timely fashion. The woman deserved to go to the headsman for the mire she had driven the tower into, a mire Elida now had to dig out of, much less for daring to blackmail the Ammerlin's Seat. Matin Stepanaeus cut off abruptly, taking half a step back on the patterned Tarabonner carpet. Elida wiped the frown from her face. Thinking of Alviarin always made her glare unless she was careful. "Your rooms are comfortable enough for you," she said into the silence. "The serving men are suitable." He blinked at the sudden change of direction.
"The rooms do be comfortable and the serving men suitable," he replied in a much milder tone, perhaps remembering her frown. "Even so, I—"
"You should be grateful to the tower, Matin Stepanaeus, and to me. Randall Thor took Ilion only days after you departed the city. He took the laurel crown as well. The Crown of Swords, he named it. Can you believe he would have faltered in cutting off your head to take it? I knew you would not leave voluntarily. I saved your life."
There. He should believe it had been done with his best interests at heart now. The fool had the temerity to snort and fold his arms across his chest.
"I am no a toothless old hound yet, mother. I did face death defending Ilion many times. Do you believe I fear dying so much I would rather be your guest for the rest of my life?"
Still, that was the first time he had given her her proper title since entering the room. The ornate gilded case clock standing against the wall chimed, small figures of gold and silver and enamel moving on three levels. On the highest, above the clock face, a king and queen knelt to an Ammerlin's Seat. Unlike the wide stole resting on Elida's shoulders, that Ammerlin's stole still had the seven stripes. She had not yet gotten around to bringing in an enameler.
There was so much to be done that was so much more important. Adjusting her stole on the bright red silk of her dress, she leaned back so the flame of Tarvalin, picked out in moonstones on the tall gilded chairback, would stand directly above her head. She intended to make the man take in every symbol of who she was and what she represented. Had the flame-topped staff been at hand, she would have held it under his crooked nose. A dead man can reclaim nothing, my son. From here, with my help, it may be that you can reclaim your crown and your nation. Matin Stepanaeus's mouth opened a crack and he inhaled deeply, like a man scenting a home he had never thought to see again.
And how would you arrange that, mother? I understand the city do be held by these Ashaman,
he fumbled the cursed name slightly,
and Aiel, who follow the dragon reborn.
Someone had been talking to him, telling him too much. His news of events was to be strictly rationed. It seemed his serving man would have to be replaced. But hope had washed the anger from his voice, and that was to the good. Regaining your crown will require planning and time, she told him, since at the moment she had no idea of how it could be accomplished. She certainly intended to find a way, however. Kidnapping the King of Ilion had been meant to demonstrate her power, but restoring him to a stolen throne would demonstrate it even further. She would rebuild the full glory of the White Tower at its highest, the days when thrones trembled if the Amyrlin seat frowned. I am sure you are still weary from your journey, she said, standing, just as if he had undertaken it of his own free will. She hoped he was intelligent enough to make that pretense, too. It would serve them both far better than the truth in the days to come. We will dine together at midday and discuss what might be done. Cariandra, escort His Majesty to his rooms and see to fetching a tailor. He will need new clothes made. A gift from me. The plump Gildan in red, who had been standing still as a mouse beside the door to the anteroom, glided forward to touch his arm. He hesitated, reluctant to go, but Elida continued as though he were already leaving. Tell Tarna to come in to me, Cariandra. I have a great deal of work today, she added for his benefit. At last Matin Stepanaeus let himself be turned, and she sat down again before he reached the door. Three lacquered boxes were arranged just so on the tabletop. One her correspondence box, where she kept recently received letters and reports from the Ajahs. The red shared whatever their eyes and ears learned, she thought they did, but the other Ajahs still provided only dribbles, though they had produced a number of unwelcome pieces of information in the last week or so. Unwelcome in part because they indicated contact with the rebels that must go beyond those farcical negotiations. It was the fat gold-embossed leather folder in front of her that she opened, however. The tower itself generated enough reports to have buried the table had she tried to read them all herself, and Tarvalin produced 10 times as many. Clerks handled the vast majority, selecting only the most important for her to read. They still made a thick stack. "You wanted me, mother?" Tarna said coolly, shutting the door behind her. There was no disrespect in it. The yellow-haired woman was cold by nature, her blue eyes icy. Elida did not mind that. What irritated her was that the bright red keeper's stole around Tarna's neck was little more than a wide ribbon. Her pale gray dress was slashed with enough red to display her pride in her Aja, so why was her stole so narrow? But Elida had a great deal of trust in the woman, and of late that was a rare commodity. What news from the harbor, Tarna? There was no need to say which. North Harbor alone had any hope of remaining functional without massive repairs. Only river ships of the shallowest draft can enter, Tarna said, crossing the carpet to stand in front of the writing table. She might have been discussing the possibility of rain. Nothing fazed her. But the rest are taking turns tying up to the part of the chain that's Quendiar so they can offload into barges. The ship captains complain, and it takes considerably longer, yet for the time being we can make do. Elida's mouth compressed, and she drummed her fingers on the tabletop. For the time being. She could not begin to repair the harbors until the rebels finally collapsed. So far they had not launched an assault, thank the light.
That might begin with soldiers only, yet sisters certainly would be drawn into it, something they must want to evade as much as she did. But raising the harbor towers, as repairs would require, laying the harbors open and defenseless might lead them to desperate acts. Light. Fighting must be avoided, if at all possible. She intended to fold their army into the tower guard once they realized they were finished and returned to the tower. Part of her already thought as if Gareth Bryn were commanding the tower guard for her. An infinitely better man for High Captain than Jamar Chubane. The world would know the White Tower's influence then. She did not want her soldiers killing one another, any more than she wanted the tower weakened by her Aes Sedai killing one another. The rebels were hers as much as those inside the tower, and she meant to make them acknowledge it. Picking up the top sheet from the stack of reports, she scanned it rapidly. "Apparently, despite my express order, the streets are still not being cleaned. Why?" An uneasy light appeared in Tarna's eyes, the first time Elida had ever seen her look troubled. "People are frightened, Mother. They don't leave their homes except at need, and with great reluctance even then. They say they have seen the dead walking in the streets." "This has been confirmed?" Elida asked quietly. Her blood suddenly seemed chill. "Have any sisters seen them?" "None in the red, that I know of." The others would speak with her as keeper, yet not freely, not to share confidences. How, under the light, was that to be mended? "But people in the city are adamant. They have seen what they've seen." Slowly, Elida set the page down to one side. She wanted to shiver. So, she had read everything she could find concerning the last battle, even studies and foretellings so old they had never been translated out of the old tongue and had lain covered in dust in the darkest corners of the library. The Althor boy had been a harbinger, but now it seemed that Tarmon Gaiden would come sooner than anyone had thought. Several of those ancient foretellings from the earliest days of the tower said the dead appearing was the first sign, a thinning of reality as the Dark One gathered himself. There would be worse before long. "Have the tower guards drag able-bodied men out of their houses if need be," she said calmly. "I want those streets clean, and I want to hear that a start was made today. Today." The other woman's pale eyebrows lifted in surprise. She had lost her usual frigid self-control. But all she said, of course, was, "As you command, Mother." Elida projected serenity, but it was a charade. What would come, and she still had secured no hold on the Althor boy. To think she had once had him right under her hand! If only she had known then. Curse Alviarin and that triply cursed proclamation calling anathema on anyone who approached him save through the tower. She would have recalled it, except that would seem weakness, and in any case the damage had been done beyond simple mending. Still, soon she would have Elaine back in hand, and the royal house of Andor was the key to winning Tarmon Gaiden. That she had foretold long ago, and news of rebellion against the Seanchan sweeping across Tarabon had been very pleasant reading. Not everything was a tangle of briars stabbing her from every side. Scanning the second report, she grimaced. No one liked sewers, yet they were one-third of the life's blood of a city, the other two being trade and clean water. Without the sewers, Tarvalin would become prey to a dozen diseases, overwhelming anything the sisters could do, not to mention even more malodorous than the rotting garbage must have made the streets already. Though trade was cut to a trickle for the moment, the water still came in at the upriver end of the island and was distributed to water towers throughout the city, then to fountains, ornamental and plain, that anyone was free to use. But now it seemed the sewer outlets on the downriver end of the island were nearly clogged. Dipping her pen in the ink jar, she scrawled, "I want these cleared by tomorrow," across the top of the page, and signed her name below. If the clerks had any sense, the work was already underway. But she never accused clerks of having much sense. The next report made her own eyebrows rise. "Rats inside the tower? That was beyond serious. This should have been on top. Have someone check the wards, Tarna." Those wardings had held since the tower was built. but perhaps they could have weakened after 3,000 years. How many of those rats were the Dark One's spies? A rap came at the door, followed an instant later by a plump accepted named Annamara, who spread her striped skirts in a deep curtsy.
"If it pleases you, Mother, Phalana Sedai and Nagain Sedai have brought a woman to you they found wandering in the tower. They say she wants to present a petition to the Amarlin seat."
"Tell her to wait and offer her tea, Annamara," Tarna said briskly. "The mother is busy."
"No, no," Elida broke in.
"Send them in, child, send them in."
It had been too long since anyone had come to present her with a petition. She was of a mind to grant whatever it was, if it was not too ridiculous. Perhaps that would restart the flow. It was far too long since any sisters had come to her without being summoned, too. Perhaps the two Browns would end that drought as well. But only one woman entered the room, carefully closing the door behind her. By her silk riding dress and good cloak, she appeared to be a noblewoman or a prosperous merchant, a supposition supported by her confident manner. Elida was sure she had never met the woman before, yet there seemed something vaguely familiar about that face, framed by hair even fairer than Tarna's. Elida stood and started around the table, hands outstretched and an unaccustomed smile on her face. She tried to make it seem welcoming.
"I understand that you have a petition for me, my daughter. Tarna, pour her some tea."
The silver pot sitting on a silver tray atop the side table must still be at least warm.
"The petition, it was something I let them believe in order to reach you unbruised, Mother," the woman replied in Tarabonner accents, curtsying, and halfway through that, her face was suddenly that of Baen and Marinya.
Embracing Sidar, Tarna wove a shield on the woman, but Elida contented herself with planting her fists on her hips.
"To say that I'm surprised you dare show me your face would be an understatement, Baenin."
"I managed to become part of what you might call the ruling council in Saladar," the Grey said calmly. "I made sure they sat there and did nothing, and I put the rumors about that many among them were in truth your secret adherents. The sisters, they were looking at one another with so much suspicion, I think me most might have returned to the tower soon at that point. But then other sitters beside the Blues appeared. The next I knew, they had chosen their own hall of the tower, and the ruling council, it was done. Still, I continued to do what I could. I know that you commanded me to remain with them until they were all ready to return, but that must happen within days now. If I may say, Mother, it was the most excellent decision not to try Egwene. For one thing, she has the genius for discovering new weaves, even better than Elaine Trakand or Nynaeve Almira. For another, before they raised her, Lilaine and Ramonda struggled with one another to be named Amarlin. With Egwene alive, they will struggle again, but neither can succeed. Yes? Me, I think very soon now, sisters will begin following behind me. In a week or two, Lilaine and Ramonda will find themselves alone with the remainder of their so-called hall.
How did you know the Alvir girl wasn't to be tried? Elida demanded. How did you know she's even alive? Unshield her, Tarna.
Tarna complied, and Baenin gave her a nod as if in gratitude. A small gratitude. Those large blue-gray eyes might make Baenin appear constantly startled, but she was a very composed woman. Combine composure with a wholehearted dedication to the law, and also ambition, which she possessed in as great a measure, and Elida had known immediately that Baenin was the one to send off after the sisters fleeing the tower.
And the woman had failed utterly. Oh, she had apparently sowed a little dissension, but really she had achieved nothing of what Elida had expected from her. Nothing. She would find her rewards commensurate with her failure.
Egwene, she can enter Telairanriod simply by going to sleep, Mother. I myself have been there and seen her, but I must use a Turang Real. I could not acquire any of those the rebels have to bring with me. In any event, she spoke to Swan Sanche in her dreams, it is claimed, though I think more likely in the world of dreams. Apparently she said that she is a prisoner, but she would not tell where, and she forbade any rescue attempt. May I pour myself that tea?
Elida was so stunned she could not speak. She motioned Baenin to the side table, and the Grey curtsied again before going over to feel the silver pitcher cautiously with the back of her hand.
The girl could enter
tell Iranriod? And there were Turangriol that allowed the same thing? The world of dreams was almost a legend. And according to those troubling scraps the Ajahs had deigned to share with her, the girl had rediscovered the weave for traveling and made any number of other discoveries as well. They had been the determining factor in her decision to preserve the girl for the tower, but this on top of it?
If Egwene can do this, Mother, perhaps she really is a dreamer, Tarna said. The warning she gave Sylviana is useless, Tarna. The Shan Shan are still deep in Altara and barely touching Ilion.
At least the Ajahs were still willing to pass on everything they learned of the Shan Shan. Or rather, she hoped they passed on everything. The thought roughened her voice.
Unless they learn to travel, can you think of any precaution I need to take beyond what is already in place?
She could not, of course.
The girl had forbidden a rescue.
That was good on the face of it, but it indicated she still thought of herself as Amarlin. Well, Sylviana would remove that nonsense from her head soon enough if the sisters teaching her classes failed. Can she be fed enough of that potion to keep her out of Tel Iranriod?
Tarna grimaced slightly. No one liked that vile brew, even the Browns who had brought themselves to test it, and shook her head.
We can make her sleep through the night, but she would be useless for anything the next day. And who can say whether it would affect this ability of hers?
May I pour for you, Mother?
Bayonin said, balancing a thin white teacup on her fingertips.
Tarna? The most important news I have...
I don't care for any tea, Elida said harshly.
Did you bring back anything to save your skin from your miserable failure? Do you know the weave for traveling or the skimming or...
There were so many. Perhaps they were all talents and skills that had been lost, but apparently most had not been named yet. The gray peered at her across the teacup, her face very still.
Yes, she said at last. I cannot make Quendiar, but I can make the new healing weaves work as well as most sisters, and I know them all.
An edge of excitement crept into her voice.
The most marvelous is traveling.
Without asking permission, she embraced the source and wove spirit. A vertical line of silver appeared against one wall and widened into a view of snow-covered oaks. A cold breeze blew into the room, making the flames dance in the fireplace.
That is called a gateway. It can only be used to reach a place you know well, but you learn a place by making a gateway there, and to go somewhere you do not know well, you use skimming.
She altered the weave, and the opening dwindled into that silvery line once more, then widened again. The oaks were replaced by blackness, and a gray-painted barge railed and gated that floated on nothing against the opening.
"Release the weave," Elida said.
She had the feeling that if she walked over to that barge, the darkness would extend as far as she could see in any direction, that she could fall in it forever. It made her queasy. The opening, the gateway, vanished. The memory remained, however. Resuming her seat behind the table, she opened the largest of the lacquered boxes, decorated with red roses and golden scrollwork. From the top tray, she picked up a small ivory carving, a fork-tailed swallow dark yellow with years, and stroked her thumb along the curved wings.
"You will not teach these things to anyone without receiving my permission."
"But why ever not, Mother?"
"Some of the Ajahs oppose the Mother almost as strongly as those sisters beyond the river," Tarna said.
Elida shot a dark look at her keeper, but that cool visage absorbed it without changing a hair.
"I will decide who is reliable enough to be taught, Bayonin. I want your promise. No, I want your oath. On my way here, I saw sisters of different Ajahs glaring at one another. Glaring. What has happened in the tower, Mother?"
"Your oath, Bayonin."
The woman stood peering into her teacup long enough that Elida was beginning to think she would refuse. But ambition won out. She had tied herself to Elida's skirts in the hope of preferment, and she would not abandon that now.
"Under the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth, I swear that I will teach the weaves I learned among the rebels to no one without the permission of the Amarlin seat."
She paused, taking a sip from the cup.
Some sisters in the tower, they are perhaps less reliable than you think. I tried to stop it, but that ruling council sent 10 sisters to return to the tower and spread the tale of the Red Aja and Loghain. Elida recognized few of the names she reeled off, until the last. That one made her sit bolt upright.
"Shall I have them arrested, Mother?" Tarna asked, still as chill as ice.
"No. Have them watched. Watch whoever they associate with." So there was a conduit between the Ajas inside the tower and the rebels. How deeply had the rot spread? However deep, she would clean it out.
"That may be difficult as matters stand, Mother."
Elida slapped the table with her free hand, a sharp crack. "I didn't ask whether it would be difficult. I said do it! And inform Maid Donnie that I invite her to dinner this evening." The woman had been persistent in trying to resume a friendship that had ended many years before. Now she knew why. "Go and do that now." A shadow crossed Tarna's face as she curtsied.
"Don't worry," Elida said. "Bayonin can feel free to teach you every weave she knows."
She did trust Tarna, after all, and it certainly made her expression brighter, if no warmer. As the door closed behind her keeper, Elida pushed the leather folder to one side and leaned her elbows on the table, focusing on Bayonin. "Now, show me everything.